Welcome to the Ask Me About Marine Insurance podcast. I'm your host, Alexander McGinley. Today, our guest is Yura Klimczyk, Senior Risk Account Consultant for Marine in the Americas. Welcome to the show, Yura.
Welcome, Alexander. Thank you for inviting me.
Yura, it was great to see you in Houston recently. You were speaking at the RightShip Maritime Forum, and you covered a lot of interesting topics ranging from cyber to sizable losses to new and emerging trends. And I really want to talk about that today because I think that our listeners are going to find it to be very interesting. We're going to kick it off on a topic that some of our listeners may not be aware of, and that is what's called the dark fleet. So tell me, what is a dark fleet? Sounds ominous, sounds like something straight out of a Star Wars movie. So let's hear about that.
Yes, thank you, Alexander, for again, for introduction and especially for organizing this interview. And indeed, we had a very good actually interaction with the audience during the presentation. That's the reason I think, you know, we can share actually some kind of our knowledge and how do we understand and what is happening on the market. And indeed, dark fleet might be a little bit misleading. What does it mean actually? Dark fleet, you know, some of the publication or some of the other, you know, industry experts, they sometimes call it shadow fleet. But actually the dark fleet is something which is not new to the industry. So looking in the hindsight, especially in the history, and going back to 2018, when the President Trump actually reimposed the previous sanction on Iran, which actually started to use the growing fleet of tankers to continue its oil export, because otherwise it would be suppressed. And we know that some countries actually, their GDP is actually based on the export of oil and on the production. That's right. And then 2019, actually, you know, looking again on the Venezuela, almost the same happened. So when Venezuelan oil was put on the sanction as well, so again, the term or the fleet started to grow and the tankers start moving the cargo, even though there were sanctions. So now we have the recent situation, which brings probably another light and another magnitude to the problem, because the shadow of dark fleet is growing exponentially, and to the extent we probably cannot right now measure very accurately. So President Putin actually, since the conflict between Russia and Ukraine started in 2 years ago, actually he said that, you know, he's not going to sell the oil under the price cap mechanism, which actually was imposing the maximum price for the barrel of the oil, $60. And so, of course, it became a little bit the problem for the Russia, because they couldn't generate expected profit. So they needed to create or actually contribute to growth of the dark fleet. That's the reason why the dark fleet or the shadow fleet is growing. And as a side note, actually, we need to remember that because it's a illicit and actually the activity which is under sanction, so of course there is elevated risk for people involved, the business become very lucrative.
Right, so it's a dangerous business, but a highly lucrative one. And as you're implying, it's one that's grown significantly over the past few years. So I imagine that the figures must be difficult to get, but what do you estimate to be the size of this fleet? How many vessels are we talking about?
Right. So, of course, I cannot made up and express my opinion. I need to use the sources. And according actually to the Lloyd's List intelligence data from September, they actually counted about 535 tankers, which the aggregated deadweight is about 75 million tons. That's about like 12% of the internationally trading fleet, which you can
that's
you
a
can
big
imagine.
Number. Wow,
absolutely. And the average age is 23, although you might have think that 23 years is pretty old, but for a tankers it's probably not that bad, because tankers usually are built up to certain standards or to the higher standards than other vessels. But, you know, to keep the standards up, you need to actually keep the vessel maintained. And this mechanism of the maintenance and investing in the shadow fleet might not working as it works for a standard fleet. Then we need to also, again, going back to the figures from the Lloyd's List intelligence, about 2/3 of the tankers have no P&I coverage. And the class is also unknown for about 70% when we thinking about the deadweight. So not the number, but the deadweight. They also counted about 200 tankers, which are directly linked to the Russian trading. That's in addition to Sovcom flot and the Greek-owned tankers, which the Sovcom flot is about 80 tankers, then the Greek-owned tanker is about 90 ships, but they are not actually defined as a dark fleet because they trading the oil. However, they trading the oil below the cap. And yes, absolutely. And the European owners, mainly Greek owned, in about 40%, carry Russian crude oil without breaching sanction. And again, the reason for that, because they're trading below $60 per barrel. Two in every three tankers that ship oil from Russia over August, for example, were not compliant with the G7 sanctions. So again, you know, they are different. The numbers may be confusing, but in case someone can visualize, it's really the problem is growing in terms of the dark fleet. And again, 108 out of 334 tankers truck loading from the 8 of the largest Russian ports, and which had Western Marine insurance indicating compliance, or 42 when measured by deadweight. The last figure was about 2/3 in comparison to the last year.
That's extremely interesting. You know, the thing that stood out to me when you were giving that report is that a lot of these vessels have no known P&I coverage. That's an extremely critical coverage when it comes to marine insurance. So give me an explanation on why are they not buying the coverage? I mean, it's just integral to running the operation.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is where the problem actually has their own problem, because likely they would like to have the P&I cover, but the P&I cover cannot be procured, cannot be bought, because no one wants to sell them. The reason why is, but before actually we answer this question, is let's maybe tell the audience what is the P&I insurance. The P&I insurance is actually mandatory for all ship owners who use the vessel for commercial or transportation purposes when carrying passenger, workers, cargo across international waters. So it's mandatory. Then actually, in order to enter ports worldwide, especially in international trading, the master of the vessel is required to provide the certificate of entry, which actually denominate the name of the insurance. So the port authorities can actually get approved that the vessel enter into the agreement with the club and is covered by P&I. Typical P&I cover will include, of course, and this is the crux of the problem,
right?
The carrier's third-party risk for damage caused to cargo during carriage, war risk, risk of environmental damage such as oil spills and pollution. So this is actually what the P&I is supposed to cover. And then looking again on them into the number, over 90% of the world's merchant fleet actually enter with the P&I clubs, which provide third-party liability insurance to ship owners. However, there is a number of ship owners which never enter P&I clubs, and usually they are large shipping companies, and they do have their own insurance arrangements, for example, like captive. So they can afford actually to allocate certain amount of money and actually cover or take the risk and actually self-insure themselves in terms of the P&I. So this is how it works. And I believe that, you know, that if you're talking about the dark fleet, of course, and again, what I mentioned that they would like to have, the problem is once you involve in the illicit activities, majority of the policies will be void.
Right.
So automatically they cannot be covered. And if they cover and there is a loss, and probably investigation will prove that the vessel was carrying or lifting the sanctioned oil, I believe that P&I cover might be not working for them anyway. So
yeah, they probably would deny the claim. Yeah,
absolutely. So this is the major problem. And also we need to be aware, because every P&I club, as we do as well on the hull and machinery, we have our screening and vetting processes. So we usually will ask about ownership of the company, flag, so we can even before registering the vessel into our policy, we can actually screen them and find out, you know, whether the vessel has the legitimate owner, or actually the beneficiary owner is actually obfuscated and cannot be discovered.
Right. Well, again, this is something that we probably could talk about for hours, but as I said, we have a lot to cover. So I want to shift sea lanes, if I may use that expression correctly, and talk about another issue that you discussed at this RightShip Maritime Forum, and that is the growing shortage of seafarers. So as we're all aware, go to a restaurant or shop retail or buy something online, there aren't enough people to do the work, seemingly, right? So there's a lot of job openings, and that extends also to the maritime industry. So, you know, but it seems strange to me, because, you know, I would think, particularly with so much interest in the industry, that a lot of people would be applying for the work, and it seems to be an exciting job. So maybe you can explain that, why there's a shortage of seafarers.
Yeah, that's a very good question, Alexander. I appreciate asking that. So I think that the major thing is actually quality of life. So I believe that especially for a young generation, they must be sort of the attractiveness of the job in terms of the career, maybe money, sometimes maybe opportunities. And then they, of course, will try to pursue the job which does offer those kinds of the things. I don't think actually that the recent sort of the job as a seafarer is that attractive, or it may be attractive on the very short term. For example, as a matter of curiosity, so some people may be looking for adventure.
Hey, once you actually do it, it might be a different story, right?
Okay. Absolutely, yes.
And absolutely. And you know that, having run a ship yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the people were reading Joseph Conrad books and, you know, how romantic sailing is and those kind of the stuff. But, you know, the reality is a little bit different. But there is another component as well. You know, of course, the technology, and probably we can touch a little bit later on this one, but the technology in some sense, actually, so one of the triggers which made decision to stop sailing was actually technology, or actually that time it was communication, where the center of command was like slowly moving from the vessel, from the captain to the shore.
Right.
The reason, because, you know, the people can communicate 24/7. So sometimes captain was not, I cannot say entitled, because the captain is still entitled, but actually sometimes it's much easier to call the office and actually ask for advice instead of making decision by himself or by myself. So I think that the communication, the way that people start communicating, changed the way how this job was actually executed. And on another thing, actually, that there was the huge number of the bureaucracy which was imposed. I don't want to mention as in the negative context, but, you know, as a seafarers, you know, we, or, you know, or as an industry, you know, we doing different jobs instead of the, you know, like filling up the papers. But, you know, right. The different codes, especially ISM code, later on after 1911, actually impose a lot of checklists and a lot of administrative jobs on the ship's crew, which required to literally filling papers, and the papers supposed to help the job, but, you know, on top of the helping the job, they created additional burden and an additional workload. So I think a couple of the components altogether make actually the job being non-attractive. Needless to say that, you know, staying 9 months, 4 months, 6 months away from the family is a big challenge. So not many people would compromise that, I believe, to actually, you know, even probably there is no money which can pay this kind of the loneliness and being away from the family, at least for some people.
Right. You know, the other thing too, I think that is that with increasing automation, there probably are, you know, fewer workers on the vessels as a whole. How are the seafarers adopting, or rather adapting, to that shift to automation? Do they, you know, like many workers, such as in the transportation industry, for example, we have automated trucks and things of that sort, where there's a growing concern that significant parts of the economy are going to change rapidly due to automation, and it could lead to significant unemployment in certain industries. Do you think that there's a danger of the seafarers being replaced by machines? And, you know, what should they do to adapt to the situation?
Right, Alexander. I think, you know, another very good question. And I think it links to the previous question, what we talk about, the attractiveness of the job. I personally don't think that there is an imminent risk that the seafarers will be replaced by machine robots and automation. And, you know, looking again in the history, when actually computers were becoming like a, you know, like a daily bread or a daily tour for many, many humans working, you know, there was probably very similar concern. What's going to happen to us? You know, will the computer take over and will they do the job for us or on our behalf? And, you know, being like probably already 30 years, you know, in the operation, the computer actually even became much better, but they didn't replace the humans. Actually, what happened, that definitely some jobs might have vanished, like, you know, disappear completely. So definitely there was like a very slow move of the skill sets. So the skill sets, right, which were relevant and adequate, you know, 20 years ago, maybe in 20 years ago will not be relevant, but it doesn't mean that there will be no humans. There will be always human. And even, you know, there is a lot of discussion about the autonomous vessel, what's going to happen, you know, but, you know, even if you have the autonomous vessel, I don't think the level of autonomy, especially in shipping, will allow that those vessels will have like sort of the self-conscious, can make decision on whatever they want to do. They will be the level of the autonomy, but still will be controlled by the human. So again, needless to say, there are some jobs which cannot be replaced by robots, by computers, and they are like a simple jobs, you know, even like painting the deck or removing, yes, rust, or, you know, filling up the tank with the additional oil, taking samples of the oil. So there is a number of the very small jobs which still will require the human intervention. And again, one of the basic actually activity for any vessel is bringing the vessel to the port and, you know, like putting the vessel, I will use a little bit like a simplistic language, putting the vessel on the rope. So, you know, this kind of the tying up the vessel to the bollards, it cannot be done by the computer. There must be people doing that, you know, handing the ropes, putting on the bollards, you know, putting on the winches, tightening them. So I think there is a number of things which cannot be replaced. So I don't think that the shipping is at the imminent threat to be subject of revolutionary technological change. Is not going to happen. And I think there is a time that there is certain latency which will allow actually seafarers probably to adopt. And some of us or some of them will already retire when the new generation might have a completely different skill set.
Exactly. So it sounds like if the job can be automated, it will, but there's a large percentage of jobs that simply cannot be, and there'll be an increasing need for specialization. And there shouldn't be any significant changes in that regard in the years to come. There is another risk, however, that ship owners and vessel operators and, you know, any worker on a ship would have to contend with. And this is something that we didn't see until fairly recently. And that is, as we shift on to another topic, that's the exposure to cyber loss. This is something that all of us in business are very familiar with. And of course, in the insurance industry, we're very familiar with it. There are entire units dedicated to providing cyber insurance. But it isn't something that I would say is talked about to the same degree in the shipping industry than perhaps you would find in, you know, in other industries. That may change over time, but I, you know, many of the large cyber losses that are reported in the media typically don't involve the shipping industry, although there certainly are some, which I know you're going to talk about later on. But give us your insight into what are some of the biggest cyber risks that a vessel operator or a ship-owning company would face.
So, yes, absolutely. The cyber risk, I think, is really, you know, on the focus from many insurance company, but not only company, shipping industry is definitely looking what was going to happen. The problem here is actually there is no, like, a history, like, you know, like a very tangible data, which, you know, could actually be used to understand really what may happen. We're learning. It's a little bit trial and error process, I think. But again, like, you know, trying to, I know that we don't have much time to talk about every topic. So, like, scratching the surface a little bit on this one, the point is that the ships become actually more interconnected with outside world. I mentioned in my first, almost at the beginning, that one of the reason I moved actually or decided to retire from the seafarer career was actually the communication. So because of the communication and now data, you know, the data flows actually between the vessel and the and onshore or shore. So this definitely changes. And, you know, this process, once started, it cannot be stopped. I think so. We will only see actually that there is more data being exchanged. So there is a shift, you know, using, for example, electronic charts. So I was using paper charts. Now actually majority of the charts are being used in the electronic form, the same as you see in GPS. And of course, like every GPS or, you know, every computer, it needs actually the update of the map, or even the update of the software, or maybe the firmware. So this is what is happening. And the same is for engines. Engine becomes much more complicated. There is a lot of electronics. So, you know, anyway, long story short, there is much more electronic these days on the vessel than used to be. There is a lot of computers. The majority of the processes are automated or self-automated using, again, electronic data. And those systems may be connected with the onshore, and just, you know, not dwelling too much on this topic. So, for example, some kind of the diagnosis you can do right now, actually, you know, remotely. So, for example, there was a failure on the engine, the vessel is sailing. So literally, the engine manufacturer can access the engine data or the engine system actually via remote connection and actually diagnosed what is wrong with the engine.
Right.
So it of course, you know, any technology creating the new risk, and I think we are exactly in this place that, you know, all these advantages will create additional risk to us.
Well, that's a very good point, because there's a benefit, just like anything, the cost-benefit analysis, you look at, does the benefit outweigh the cost? And I would say probably in aggregate, certainly the benefit of automation outweighs the cost. But one of those costs definitely was not contemplated to be the cyber risk. And, you know, I know that it's a growing concern for the insurance industry, and many of the companies have an outright cyber exclusion. There are opportunities to buy it back, et cetera, in certain situations. And there are certain facilities that are dedicated to that explicitly. But, you know, you've got a crystal ball, so to speak. Do you think that the industry is at risk of a big cyber attack? And from your vantage point, what do you think something of that sort would look like?
So we had a couple of the examples recently. So January 7, 2023, there was a ransomware attack on the Ship Manager software system, which is developed by DNV, one of the largest and the most, probably one of the most reputable classification society. And the system, actually, Ship Manager, is sort of the platform where the ship owners can exchange data, or actually can store the data. And they lost, actually. So in a little bit simplistic way, of course, it's a software, but I think it's a cloud-based software. So the access actually was completely blocked for 2 weeks. They were working, I don't want to, you know, say something wrongly, but there were a couple of days, I think week, maybe a little bit longer, where actually the software was blocked from the access. So for some owners, which are sort of the dependent on the...
Wow.
entering or accessing those data, those definitely the problem. So I really don't know how works the backup, you know, of this kind of the platform. But anyway, it was an issue. It was the industry well acknowledged the fact that, you know, there was a threat and it happened. Then, you know, a couple of years earlier, 2020, there was a ransom attack actually on one of the biggest actually French container shipping giants, CMA CGM, and the disruption was actually for the e-commerce operation. And you know when they did sort of the loss analysis, they actually found out that there was like a $15 million loss because of one attack. But probably the most famous one is actually the one which happened in 2017. So we're going back like a 6 years
I've
ago.
I've heard about that one, yeah.
So Danish company, the shipping giant Maersk, actually was hit by infamous NotPetya. And, you know, they estimated the cost, like a direct cost, was $300
million. $300 million. That is a huge number.
Absolutely.
My goodness.
But then you have another companies which actually were connected and impacted, and they had their own losses. For example, TNT, I think, estimated they lost like a $400 million, you know, because of this attack, because maybe they couldn't trade or they couldn't transact the booking note, or they couldn't exchange the data. I think the way they sort of they calculated is a little bit, you know, at least not to me known, but I think what I read that actually globally, probably this kind of the ransom attack cost about $10 billion globally, including Russia, where it actually originated from. So yeah. This is the scope actually, or the exposure we may face in the future.
Well, I certainly hope that it won't become the new normal, but I'm afraid that it will be, because it's an extremely lucrative venture, cybercrime. But you know, the thing that I also am curious about is that, you know, these are the big events that are reported in the media. They get a lot of attention. But I'm sure that there has to be a high percentage of losses that actually don't make it out into the media. So do you think that there's a lot of that as well?
Yeah, so I think the cyber risk is a little bit like you need to have the magic wand really to find out, you know what really happened, especially in the shipping, because it could be very difficult actually to differentiate or delineate or maybe even to find the root cause why, for example, something happened. If you have the machinery failure and the question would be, did it happen because there was a cyber attack, or did it happen because it was fatigue, or did it happen because there was no maintenance, or there might be some human error? So I think majority of the moving parts will come into the game. And I think whether we do have expertise actually to find it out, especially, is another question. Maybe those risks will be detectable, going forward in the future. But I think right now, in my view, majority of the risk, or maybe losses, if happened, they might actually remain probably undetected.
And
another thing is actually how you're going to quantify them. So it creates, because it's not only like a physical damage, but it triggers also probably liability. And I don't want to start another topic here about the liabilities, especially when it comes to the software, hardware, you know, how this actually can play among the different stakeholders. So but I think definitely that's the reason probably we do have a problem, even to quantify, you know, how much premium should be taken for the cyber, because no loss history, and very difficult to measure something, and also very difficult probably to detect.
Correct. Well, again, that's another topic that we probably could talk about for hours, but I want to shift on to another area that you covered during your presentation. You know, as we're all aware, supply chain risk is a huge concern. It affects consumers, it affects business people, you know, large and small, from Main Street to Wall Street, big retailers. And I think that the problem is probably just going to continue to grow. But, supply chain risk is certainly something that's a concern, and certainly the shortage associated with that. But it's as equally important to know where are all of your assets? So I think it's highlighted the fact that it's important to know exactly what you've got and where. So, you know, why don't you talk a little bit about why supply chain traceability is so important to the maritime industry, and not only the maritime industry, but for the insurance industry as well?
Absolutely. Again, very great topic and very huge topic. I just try probably to say a couple of the, you know, quick words on this one. Definitely the supply chain traceability is heightened by the consumer and regulatory concerns surrounding matters as a product safety, for example, sustainability and ethical sourcing. So, you know, if you probably buy diamonds right now, you might find, okay, maybe they were actually mined by the kids somewhere in Africa.
Yeah.
So this is probably, you know, we go into the area like trying to find out, you know, how the specific product was sourced. And again, I don't want to go back actually to that discussion about the dark fleet, but it also, you know, connects actually with the dark fleet, because, you know, those kind of vessel, they're moving the oil somewhere else, or actually they discharging the sanctioned oil at the deep sea to another tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And this oil is actually sort of delegalized already, because another vessel changes the paper and saying, okay, the origin is, for example, United States. The oil goes to, you know, to the port in Europe, and no one even would imagine that this is actually Russian oil, which found another way actually to go on the market. And I think that's what we're really talking about, the traceability. So, you know, it addresses a lot of things, especially ECG, so environmental, social, governance concern. Actually, also, there was sort of the accountability, because, you know, any illicit activity is very lucrative, like we discussed. So, you know, the people may use different tricks and and actually even, you know, forging documents actually to, you know, to legalize. So I think this is the entire point about the traceability. We need to really understand actually what is happening. And again, as an insurance company who has a lot of responsibilities actually to deliver the product and ensure the cargo, which is legitimate, which is legal, which was sourced properly. You know, there was no any act of the human exploitation.
Right,
so
right.
We can ensure, or we should ensure, only those products which we are sure they are, you know, they are properly sourced. So
I mean, it sounds good, but practically speaking, you know, what can be done to address that supply chain traceability, given the fact that it's a big planet, a lot of different countries, many different standards, different laws? You know, how would you be able to do that feasibly?
So again, I try to reply very quickly. A couple of years ago, I heard about the concept of DNA, like a human DNA.
Mm.
So the cargo should have sort of the DNA. And I think the concept originated from the winemakers. So the companies which are producing wine, actually they say, okay, maybe the end customers would like to know, you know, how this wine was produced, you know, and we know that the year of the wine, but actually you sometimes that you don't know what type of the grapes was used, when the grapes were planted, or how they were actually harvested, you know, how they, you know, who was doing the fermentation processes and a lot of things. So DNA was actually sort of the concept that was tracking the cargo with the timestamps and the location and the person or the company which was doing certain activity. And actually it was compiled in one information and actually sold together with them, with the wine. So the end customer could find actually all the information going back to the origin until actually to the moment when the wine was delivered to his table. So I hope the technology definitely is evolving, maybe not today, but maybe tomorrow it will be possible for other products.
That would definitely be a real game changer. All right, well, let's move on to something different now. And of course, we're talking about a lot of interesting and exciting topics. One thing that's a great concern for logistics companies, ship owners, what have you, and insurance companies is aggregation of assets, right? And in the insurance industry, of course, we look at it from the standpoint of you're expected to have a certain level of frequency and a certain level of severity. But in many ways, the severity exposure is growing, and in some cases, perhaps to a degree that we would rather not have, just because of the aggregation of assets. So I'd like you to talk about, you know, what have been some of the largest shipping losses that have been reported, and then we'll talk later about whether anything could have been done to mitigate that, including, you know, such professionals as yourself. So let's start with some of the bigger losses that have hit the industry.
Yeah, thank you, Alexander. Yes, I think the question could be also asked, what is the most costliest loss in the shipping? Mm. So far, actually, we know that the Exxon Valdez probably cost the most to the industry because of the cleaning up cost and also the payments of the punitive damages. So I think the aggregated amount of money spent was more than $3 billion. So the oil, because of the pollution, because of the environmental aspect, has probably the most expensive. However, looking purely from the cargo perspective, so I think there is sort of the seasonality or certain moments that some losses become actually more visible than the others. And there was a time in the shipping industry between 2009-2017 that about 12 incidents related to liquefaction happened, and majority of those were total loss. So the liquefaction was actually recognized by the industry, and actually there was certain action taken. Of course, insurance companies also took the action and recommended or actually warranted certain process, which actually limited those kind of the incidents. And
can you explain what that means, Jurek, liquefaction?
So some of the bulk cargoes are actually classified as a type A under the certain code of the bulk cargoes. Hmm. It does mean that they are prone to liquefaction when the moisture content in the cargo is higher than, for example, 12%. So this moisture content is very important for the shipper and for the shipping company, because this is actually the borderline. So it means when the moisture content is, let's say, about 12%, 14%, depends on the cargo, the bulk becomes actually like a liquid, behaves. So it actually, from the sort of the semi-solid state, becomes actually like a liquid and can actually move like a water, like a very dense water from one side to another, fore and aft. So that's what we call liquefaction.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
And I know that we're running a little bit out of the time, but I can.
We've got plenty of time. Keep going.
Okay, so the liquefaction, but you know, that being said, actually, the liquefaction also became one of the greatest contributors to loss of life at sea. So, you know, according to the data from Intercargo, they published in 2023 for the period of 2013-2022. Although I mentioned about the liquefaction from 2009, because we did our own studies, actually, sort of defining out the number of the incidents. But anyway, according to the Intercargo, and this data covers 2013-2022, there were about 70 lives, means 70 people or seafarers lost their life. And this is about 67% of the total loss of life in the past 10 years. So, for example, we need to also a little bit distinguish, because in this conversation we're purely talking about the sold of the bulk carriers. We're not really talking about the like Aurora, car carriers, container, which have a different problem. So we will touch upon that, but this is purely like for the bulk segment. And the groundings actually is another big problem, because there were about 12 losses within the same period of time, which actually contributed to 46% of the total losses. There were three casualties were resulted of flooding, and they cost 22 lives. So 22 seafarers lost their life. And then again, the average live loss per ship was about 4 during the 10-year period between 2003-2020 and 3.4 between 12 and 21. So, and again, if you compare it to the previous period, 2011-2020, it was 3.56. So we see that actually, if we take the average loss of life per vessel, so actually the last measure period from 13 to 22 was probably the most costly.
I see.
But just very, you know, very quick on the fires, because the fire became actually the biggest problem. And they mainly affect not as much as the bulk carriers, although they can, but not from the cargo standpoint, because the bulk carriers might have an issue, and they do have an issue, for example, with the engine room fires. But actually, when we're talking purely about the containers, the fires on the container vessel, RoRo or car carriers, usually they will originate from the cargo. And then the question is why?
Of course. Well, yes, why indeed? So, you know, that's a good segue, because recently, Alan Ilias and Andrew D'Alessio of AXA XL in the cargo department gave a podcast, and they were talking about misdeclaration of cargo and how AI actually is being used to help root that out. But I think that definitely is one of the drivers in these types of large losses, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I mean, they there are two things, but they are again connected or interconnected, if you will. So we're talking purely about the misdeclared cargo. So some of the cargos are actually misdeclared for the purpose that, you know, usually the shipper needs to pay much more money, or the freight is much higher if the cargo are declared as a dangerous goods, because it requires the special place on the vessel. They need to be special handling. So some shippers want to avoid additional costs, and they will just misdeclare the cargo for this reason. Another reason is that some of the shipping companies, they don't want to move or carry certain type of the cargo. So again, this kind of the process will deprive from the shipper, or sorry, will deprive shipper actually to carry certain cargo. So again, they are sort of the force actually to, I'm not saying force, I mean, they, you know, according to them, they need to like falsify the documents actually. Yes. to you know, to get this cargo on board on the specific vessel. So this is one of the things. And another thing is actually everything, you know, this is the broad topic, everyone talking about the lithium-ion batteries, and we recognize there is a problem. But actually the problem is sort of the twofold. You have the lithium-ion batteries, agreed, but you have the huge number of the secondhand lithium-ion batteries, which are actually wrongly declared. And recently there was something, because, you know, all of those old batteries are collected, and they are declared like sort of the copper, like a residue or copper scrap, and they are being shipped in the containers, which again, you know, either this is, you know, done by purpose, or actually the reason for that, because, you know, everybody knows that no one wants to carry the secondhand lithium batteries or old lithium ion batteries. So they declare. So there are a number of actually factors which are playing actually a part in this process, why we do have those kind of the losses, and the cargo actually is somehow getting on board the vessel, even the carrier or the ship owner doesn't want to have it.
Right. I mean, so that's a very good explanation of it. And I would encourage the listeners to listen to the podcast that I referenced earlier, and that is using AI to address this issue of misdeclaration of cargo, again, given by Alan and Andrew. But let's put in a plug here for your services, Jurek, because as a risk consultant, you know, you're on the front lines, you're out there looking at the actual risks. The underwriter very rarely gets out to see it, right? And oftentimes, you know, the broker may be there, but not certainly to the same degree from a technical standpoint as the risk consultant. And so your services are instrumental in making sure that a good risk is in fact a good risk, maybe turning a risk that has problems into a better risk. But could some of the losses that you talked about earlier have been mitigated, or maybe, you know, avoided altogether due to effective risk consulting?
I mean, yes, I, of course, I need to sort of the, you know, stand up for the job, what we're doing on the loss prevention, my colleagues. And definitely the answer is yes. However, there is always the first time. So sometimes we have to have a loss, unfortunately, to learn something. For me, and this is what I was always like telling even the assureds, you know, we can understand that one loss happened, but we would not understand why, for example, the same type of losses happening, you know, consecutively, and nothing has been done. Because in my view, it changes a little bit like understanding of the loss, because, you know, we have an obligation, we have a duty, that we need to do something. So again, not dwelling too long on this one.
Hopefully it's a small loss.
Exactly. So if the first fire happened with the lithium ion batteries, of course, everyone, you know, was on their feet and tried to understand what happened. Then the second loss happened. And again, there was a different sort of the scenario. And then there was a third. I think we became much better right now to really mitigate those kind of the losses. I've seen a couple of the submission right now, and many of the ship owners already producing their own standard operating procedures, changing the stowage of the electric vehicles. They're using also the special suppression agents. They have a different instruments actually to detect the temperature or the rise in the temperature, or so these things happening. And again, we need to also share the knowledge. I think we as an insurance company, and especially as a risk consulting, we have an obligation, we have a duty to share the knowledge with the industry and with the clients, you know, whatever we learn, because we're monitoring, we see our clients, we know what they suffer, and we can also, you know, like use this, unfortunately, not a nice experience actually, that to limit the future losses of the which have the same character.
Right. Well, you know, they say the bad news sells. I mean, it seems that every time that I turn on the news or I read a trade journal, I'm reading about a loss such as this, particularly with the lithium batteries, fires on board vessels, et cetera. Do you think the frequency is really increasing, or is it actually exaggerated, or is it more just more severe losses as opposed to frequencies?
I mean, and again, this is because everyone can have an own opinion, and you know what we've seen so far. I think the severity is likely actually increasing. We have a much bigger exposure. One of the reasons we have much bigger ships as well. So you know, a couple of years ago, the biggest ship was whatever 11,000 TEU, maybe 13,000 TEU. Today we have a vessel which have 24,000 TEU. So definitely the exposure is increasing. In this sense, we have also much more complex cargo. So the aggregation of the asset is also, you know, much higher than it used to be. Especially the port are busier. You know, the trading routes are much busier. The good thing is actually that the frequency is probably decreasing. You know, but again, nothing can be taken as granted, because it might change. Because you know, there is a new product, new cargo, new whatever, like a lithium batteries, or you know, some of the products in the past which actually created the heavy fires. So I think one of those points is that yes, it varies, it fluctuates, but I think still the trend shows that the large losses frequency is decreasing, but severity is actually increasing.
So do you think that this is the new normal and that we should just be prepared to operate in this type of environment from an insurance and a risk standpoint?
It's a very good question. I think, you know, these processes or losses always trigger the learning process. We need to learn and we need to react or act. And we need to also, like I mentioned, we need to share our experience. And sometimes we need to actually probably participate in different industry activities, which discussing, for example, even, you know, there was a discussion ongoing about the, you know, whether it makes sense, you know, to build bigger vessels. So the question is, yeah, you may build, but the question is whether there will be the insurance company which wants to insure such a big vessel.
Right,
so,
right.
And then there is a question whether there is a salvage equipment. Then another question is whether the infrastructure is ready for those things. So I don't think that there is like a trend and an increment to the like infinite value or, you know, like to something which cannot be defined. I think there is a certain limit probably. And I believe that over the time when we become smarter actually, and we will become smarter using data, the trend actually of the severity can actually start decreasing again. So I think everything is very seasonal, not very seasonal, but they are different phases, you know. And I think this is what was going to happen with those losses.
So it sounds like the insurance industry really needs to work closely with the maritime industry as a whole to assess these exposures and provide advice and recommendations to prevent these losses from occurring, because they've already experienced them. And now it's just a matter of hopefully being able to mitigate them, you know, optimally avoid them, but to mitigate the type of loss so that it's less severe if it should occur. I want to move on to another topic, Eric, and that is something that is something that actually AXA XL has been instrumental in providing from a product standpoint, but it's this idea of excess emissions insurance. And quite frankly, I don't know a lot about it because it's not, you know, my product specialty, which really is more in the marine area rather than the ocean marine area. But, you know a lot about this. And I'm curious, you know, given all the things we talked about earlier, which is, you know, vessels very expensive to run, shortage of workers, a lot of different things to worry about, paperwork galore. Why would somebody want to buy this excess emissions coverage? Why is it so important? I would say, from what I've read about it, very little, albeit, is that it's something that is really going to be instrumental and could be transformative in the insurance industry.
Yes, I mean, we haven't spoken much for various of reason about the climate per se and about actually climate alignment, which actually shipping industry has an ambition to comply with, and is very important actually for the shipping industry, a progressive reduction of the carbon footprint. And it's not only from the environmental standpoint, but also it stay attractive for the cargo owner. So every cargo owner wants to sell the product which has, and I think this will be visible very soon, because, you know, like today you're probably reading how many calories that whatever this cookie or this pizza has.
Too many.
But maybe in the yes. future there will be, you know, what is the carbon footprint? So how much, you know, how much we polluted the environment to produce the specific product. And it probably will be very important for the clients, actually, because we were talking, you know, that we as an insurance industry have a lot of responsibility to be actually compliant and actually to save and right the environment as well. So this measurement becomes very important. And again, coming to this point, because, you know, the ship owners started to measure the carbon footprint, there is also the new regulatory regime which will require from the ship owners or manager to surrender to the authorities so-called carbon credits or corresponding to the fleet emission based on the reported data from previous years. So there will be sort of the estimation how much, let's say, I will use a little bit colloquial name, how much the specific vessel polluted the air. So based on this assumption, with some kind of the probability reduction, some kind of the verification factors, this will be measured. And okay, because I think I'm going to produce so much carbon footprint, or so much I will emit so much carbon dioxide, then I need to buy so many carbon credits. And the carbon credit becomes very important, because without the carbon credit, some countries will not allow the vessel actually to trade in their waters, or needless to say that those vessels will be banned or prohibited actually from calling those ports. So the carbon credit becomes like a very financial instrument as well, but also another instrument which actually allows the people to, sorry, allows the shipping companies to operate. But it might be the situation, for example, that the ship owner or ship operator estimated that, you know, this is the carbon footprint for my vessel, you know, based on the data from the previous year, but something happened. For example, there is a blockage of the canal, or there is a physical damage to the engine, and the vessel is not able, for example, to continue the trade, but needs to deviate and needs to go to another port to undertake the repair. So, of course, there are a number of the scenario which we will probably learn, because we also estimated, we predicted, we analyzed, but there might be the number of the scenarios which will trigger the additional emission, and the owner will be obliged to buy actually additional carbon credits, and it will be the financial cost for them. And I think this is what we as a company will cover, actually, those kind of the additional carbon credits, which will generate the additional cost to the assured, because there was a fortuitous event, either, you know, related to the accident, collision, engine, whatever will be covered in the policy. So this is actually very, in my view, very revolutionary product. And of course, you know, when I'm thinking more about this product, there are so many derivatives and so many other products you can actually probably spin off or create out of this product. I'm not going to tell you tomorrow, but I have a couple of the ideas as well of this one. So, yes. But this is, so in the nutshell, this is actually what we're trying to do for the industry as well.
And it sounds like a must have as opposed to, you know, a nice to have. And I think Ken AXA Excel is on the vanguard in providing this product. So I would encourage prospective insureds, existing insureds, brokers, or if you're in the maritime industry as a whole, to reach out to AXA Excel, and they can find more information about that product. Well, again, Jurek, thank you for your time. You're a very knowledgeable individual. Your presentation at the RightShip Maritime Forum was spot on, and this presentation for someone who couldn't make it really recaps the salient points. We've covered a lot of different things today, ranging from the dark fleet to cyber to losses to this excess emissions insurance. And I want to thank you again for attending the Ask Me About Marine Insurance podcast. Thanks, and have a good day, Jurek.
Thank you, Alexander. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.